Howdy, listener, and thanks for tuning into our podcast, The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. My name is Izzy.
And my name is David. Each week, one of us will pick a movie that the other has not seen. We will deep dive into our individual takes and historical background of the movie.
Please subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Instagram at TML A Journey Through Cinema and Twitter at TML A Journey. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of The Movie Vlog, A Journey Through Cinema. Today, we are traveling to 1966 to discuss the film The Trouble with Angels, directed by Ida Lupino, written by Blanche Hanelis, based on a book by Jane Trahey, starring Hayley Mills, Rosalind Russell, and June Harding. The movie, for those who haven't seen it, follows the adventures of two boisterous young women at St. Francis Academy as they keep the Mother Superior and other teacher nuns on their toes.
So, how you doing today, Izzy?
I'm doing great.
All right. How do you like our new digs?
I like our new digs. It's, like I said, it kind of feels a little community theater-y, and I really like it.
Yeah, I know. But
like, Mom put it best when she said it feels like a magic show. Pick a card, any card.
I know. Today, we're doing a little bit different spot as we are working on the house and things are being moved around. So, that's a lot of fun and exciting stuff.
But Dad, why did you pick the movie?
This movie? Well, this isn't exactly a movie that people would be expecting me to pick. So, that's one reason why I picked it.
For our listeners, if you hear clickety-clacks of Gollum feet, that's my dog, Bowie.
All right. So I picked this movie because it stars a couple of my favorite people in it, Rosalind Russell, and I grew up watching a lot of Hayley Mills movies, so that was a lot of fun to watch this movie. This was one of her few non-Disney movies. Hayley Mills was trying to break out of the Disney kid actor typecasting that she'd had for her early part of her career, and so she did this film as a bridge film. Rosalind Russell in the 60s is known for two different roles. This role, where she plays a Mother Superior, and of course, Mame, which she played Auntie Mame.
She's also Gypsy Rose's mother in Gypsy.
Yeah, but that was more a supporting role.
Well, yeah, but if anybody's a musical theater nerd, they would know her.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, she came from the 30s and 40s silver screen era. One of her most famous movies, of course, is His Girl Friday with Cary Grant, where they did the gender switch where there was supposed to be two guys playing the roles. She played one of the guys, and it made a much more interesting film. Because I've seen the front page, which is based on, and it's not nearly as fun as His Girl Friday. Then another reason I decided to pick this movie is because Ida Lupino is the director, and she doesn't get a lot of recognition in the film industry for being the type of director that she was. She was not the first female director, but she was like the first female director to do a film noir. And she was known for doing action films and westerns and crime films and things like that, as well as doing films that were socially relevant. And then she also did a lot of TV. A lot of people don't really know that she was the only person to act in and direct a Twilight Zone episode. She's also the only woman to ever direct a Twilight Zone episode of the original run. So there's a lot of things that she did that were really cool. And so I thought it would be fun to kind of highlight her. Blanche Hanelis, the screenwriter, would later go on to write and create for television Little House on the Prairie. So there's that. And the writer, Jane Trahey, was very famous in the advertising world. And this was like this book that she wrote was just basically based on her childhood. So those are the reasons why I picked this one. I thought it was like a fun movie with a lot of things behind it that we could talk about, some meat. Even though it's a really light and fun movie about two girls growing up in Catholic school, I thought it would be kind of, there is things behind it that are kind of fun, would be fun to talk about.
It's funny that you mentioned that she was trying to break Hayley Mills was trying to break from her Disney film because Disney film
persona.
Because to me, you could pretty much package this movie as a Disney film, especially now because I'm looking back at it at what Disney does now.
Yeah, but see, there's a couple things that's just filmed that would be shock and horror.
Well, like the smoking and the bra scene would definitely not be for television. But the thing that always makes me laugh is that was considered wholesome now, it wasn't considered wholesome back then. So I'm watching this movie going, this is a very wholesome movie. But then if I went back to the 1960s and somebody who would have grown up with because of Disney and stuff was like talking about smoking and sex and bras and things like that, I think I would be shocked.
Yeah, I think the thing too that you have to realize is that Disney movies at that point, there was no Disney Channel, so these were all theatrical run films. And so when they put out these films, people expected a very, like you said, very family wholesome film. And the smoking, the bra scene, the talking about boys, frankly, even though it's only one really quick scene, it's like, it's one of those things where people would probably not have accepted it under the Disney banner. In fact, she did a film called The Moonspinners and for Disney right before this, right after this, where she played a much more adult character, and it didn't do very well at the theater because Disney was trying to break some of that Disney-esque thing. And
this is before Touchstone and things
like
that.
Yeah, this is way before that, and even way before some of the other things that they did. And it had some issues too. And so I think the thing is that when we talk about this film is that it's also written by somebody whose childhood happened in the 30s and went to the school during the 30s. So some of that stuff was even more scandalous back in the 30s. Like the band uniforms in the 60s were kind of scandalous, and they were super scandalous because they were, you know, swimsuit style band uniforms for a Catholic school, even nowadays, would probably turn heads. So
that scene made me laugh. I was so, when Mother Superior turns around, she goes, band uniforms. It was so funny.
Because you're expecting like the long pant.
Yeah, I was expecting like them to be miserable.
I was expecting them to, when I first saw it, I remember this years ago, I was expecting them to be the like cast offs. Like they weren't.
Like they're all mismatched.
Yeah.
Or something with like a huge cross on it, you know?
No, I knew that
they were talking about gaudiness and stuff. And I was like, this is going to be.
Yeah. So I knew that they weren't going to be horrible, but it works for the film and the story. So we look at it back at it now. Even when I watched it back in the day, I knew that so much had changed in that 20, 30 years since it had been made that it still was funny to see her rebelling. And it was more, and I thought it was kind of more interesting too in the film, is that you could tell that Ida Lupino had some say in it because she rebelled a lot against Hollywood. If you read her story, it's very fascinating. And Hayley Mills' rebellion wasn't so much going out and consciously breaking the rules all the time. It was pushing back on what she thought was unfair or didn't make sense, or it was more of a fight and a rebellion of the mind, which kind of fits Ida Lupino when you read about her history. And her friend, of course, played by June Harding, who at the beginning is very much a follower and by the end has become her own person and ends up leaving. It's like that growth of womanhood where you go from being a follower to your friend to being your own woman. And then and of course, if you know the story about the woman who wrote the book, you understand that this character goes off and becomes like a copywriter. She starts working in advertising in the 50s and in the 60s, which of course, if you've seen Mad Men, is a pretty male-dominated world. And again, you have Ida Lupino directing this film in a male-dominated profession. So there's a lot of correlations in this film that was fun to you kind of watch. So it was written by the book was written by a woman. The screenplay was written by a woman, and then it was directed by a woman. Did you feel that this movie maintained a feminine point of view?
I think it did, though it was a different perspective of the female point of view, because we're talking about a different time. We're talking about different morals and different things that they find scandalous and different things that they find feminine. And I think this movie is especially since we watched Booksmart, is a great double feature to that, because it shows that you can be modest and still be feminine and still have your strength with you and enough autonomy to fight for yourself.
I see what you're saying with that. And I have to remind myself that these characters are very aware that they're in the society they're in is very male dominated at that point. I'm not saying it's not perfect yet, but we've come a long way. And the way that you could see it is the men that would burst into the Mother Superior's office, which nowadays that would never.
That, as a person as just a person who understands the stuff about it, I never understood why the outsiders, and that's what they're called in the credits, they're called outsiders, thought that it was okay for them to do that, to put themselves on top of Mother Superior, even though we all know from the get-go, because she's Mother Superior and because of the screenplay, that she is the leader and that she is.
I think it has to really do with level of respect, level of expectations. The expectations of the men in the movie, there's only a handful of men in the whole movie, and they're
all above the age of 18.
Yeah, and they all have some form of leadership. Like one of them heads another school, the other two are parents. One of them owns a shop. Actually, the man who owns the shop for the uniforms is very respectful,
except for the fact that he gives swimming suits to none. But
well, he gives. I would say that more like, you know, they're the one piece, more like showgirl style band uniforms, but it wins them the contest. So you have to say, you know, and you have to say, I guess it worked. I think the thing is that their expectation is that they, even though she runs a school that they send their kids into or their competition with, they are somehow superior to them. And I think that's the thing that also happened to Ida Lupino in her directing. She started off her first film she actually directed, she didn't get credit for because the director got sick and she was the producer and writer on it and with her husband, and she stepped in and finished directing the film. So she's all about understanding that you have to be careful with how you say thing, but the expectation was she said she didn't take the directorial, she didn't take the credit for directing the film, be out of respect for the director she was working with. But you also know if she did, there probably would have been a big, huge outcry. When she started directing her own films, she had to create her own studio with her husband, and they purposely created a studio. They knew that they weren't going to get a lot of money thrown their way because there's a woman directing, and B, they're making socially conscious films. So they purposely went after doing low budget films that were socially conscious that she directed. And they were definitely from a female point of view. One of them was called Outrage, which is about a young woman who gets raped and the effect it had in the 1950s. She's one of the few directors that has two films in the National film registry. Outrage is one of them, and the other one is The Hitchhiker. The Hitchhiker, which is the first film noir film directed by a woman. When you watch this film, this is the last feature film she makes in her career. And you can see that she's very comfortable behind the camera. She's very much like Don Siegel and Robert Aldrich, who are very minimalistic in their direction. She even called herself a poor Don Siegel. I was like, when I'm acting, I'm a poor man's Betty Davis, and when I'm directing, I'm a poor man's Don Siegel. That's what she said, which is hilarious, which is a great quote. But I think the thing is that you look at her work, you could tell that she is so used to making a lot happen with a little budget because of her independent film that she did with her husband. And when that studio, I think it stopped making movies in the mid-50s, and then she went right into directing television shows. And she did westerns, she did like The Fugitive, she did Have Gun Will Travel, which is with Richard Boone, which is a adventure western. There's definitely these, she wasn't doing like the Donna Reed Show and things like that. She was definitely going in that direction because that's what she had shown Hollywood she could do with her independent films. And so it was great. So she did a lot of things like that. She stopped directing by the end of the 60s and still was acting through the 70s. But I think the thing when you're looking at Ida Lupino's career, the way that she was able to just go after it is really kind of cool. How she wasn't getting the part she wanted, so she said, I'm going to go direct. I'm going to go write. And she did that in the 40s before a lot of people started putting hyphens in their names in Hollywood. And you've done film classes. Did Ida Lupino's name ever come up?
Actually, no, not a lot. And I think part of the reason is because when I take film classes, I'm definitely journalistically, I'm going there for journalism kind of things.
So the classes that you took, refresh me, they were focused on criticism or they were focused on theory?
Theory.
Of how to make a film?
On how to make a film. And then the only time that I've been behind a camera or / in front of a camera has been for news studio.
So for more documentary
things. For more documentary things. But I was actually surprised because I know more about Ida Lupino from acting than I did directing.
Where did you see her?
I don't see her in a lot of things, but it's kind of like that name that always pops up and you always associate somebody with acting. It's like, I don't have to see them to know that they're an actor.
Okay. Well, she kind of made her, I think the reason why she transitioned to a director of gangster and noir and action films is because that's kind of what her niche was. I think the most famous picture she did was High Sierra with Humphrey Bogart. She was known for playing in these like film noir crime movies. She was in one of the original one that always sticks out to me. It's kind of funny that I always think, why was she in that one? She was in one of the original Sherlock Holmes with Basil Rathbone.
I probably have seen her in that because I've seen all of those. I've seen all of Twilight Zone, the original and the ones that came out in 2000 something.
Yeah, so she's been around. I remember watching High Sierra when I was on a Humphrey Bogart kick, and then I went, who's that? And so I went and I watched a couple when I could, because this is back in the day when you had whatever your video store had. But this video store luckily had a couple of her, there's a whole, what do they call it, thriller suspense section, but had a bunch of film noir in it, and I was able to watch a couple of her films there, and then over time caught up on a couple of the other things. And then it was really hard to find for the longest time, really hard to find the first four or five movies that she directed, even though that they were famous for what they did, but they could talk about rape or talk about bigamy, and then a lot of them dealt with the effects of how women were treated in those situations, like in the Bigamist, like how both the women were treated by society when they found out that it was going on, what was going on. There's a lot of things in those movies, but they were hard to find. I didn't see them. even though I'd seen pictures of him, I read books about him. I think it was like 2000, 2001 when I finally saw them.
Did you like the ending of this movie? Do you think the ending is justified?
Well, that's the thing. The movie is kind of in this episodic structure. It's not a classic three-act structure that you're normally would see. So there's more like these different episodes that happen with the characters. And each episode builds on each other. So you get a better understanding of the nuns. You get a better understanding of the Mother Superior. And you get a better understanding of the two girls as they grow up. Because you see them when they first get to the academy and you follow them all the way through. So, yeah, I think the ending made sense. Because you started seeing Haley Mills starting to look at the world differently when she was left behind and had to spend the Christmases and the winters with Mother Superior at the school and the nuns. And then Rachel's character, who would go away all the time to visit her family. She also, Rachel's character, had a family that loved and supported her, and Haley Mills did not have that family. So it was definitely when Haley Mills chose at the end.
Haley Mills' character.
When Haley Mills' character chose at the end to stay and be going to the nunship, it made sense. And then, of course, that person is based on somebody real.
Yes. The book written by Jane
Trahey.
Jane Trahey wrote a book called My Life with Mother Superior.
Yes. And that character, Mary, is based on an actual person. And that person actually did stay and become a nun. In fact, about every 10, 15 years, they would run a piece on the nun that inspired my life with Mother Superior or Trouble with Angels. So they were lifelong friends. Rachel's character, who was basically Jean Trahey when she was young, goes off. And then you know from her that she goes and becomes a copywriter, and she works and she runs a in-house advertising arm for a company. And then she, in 1966, 65, she creates her own advertising firm, which is kind of unheard of to have a woman create their own advertising firm. And it's very successful. And it has, I mean, they do like high-end stuff like Bill Blass and Glamorama and all these other firms that do Bulgaria and all this other stuff that she is well known for. And it runs all the way. She's with the firm all the way till the mid-70s. It's kind of funny. There's different people who say good things about her, and there's a couple of people that say some bad things about her. I think she's just a very...
She's a complex person.
Complex person, and... From what I, she had like some like 200 different awards while she was working in advertising. So that tells you she was good at her job.
Well, you
and she knew how to pick talent, and she knew how to pick talent around her.
And you can kind of see that like story wise within this movie, because you can definitely see Rachel, the character who is based off her, grow and become a little bit more independent throughout the movie. And I think that's a, first of all, told really nicely. You know, she's starting with on the train. She's like, I don't know what to do. Help me. To getting back on the train at the end, which is a very nice bookend.
And she goes off on her adventure.
She goes on her adventure alone. And she's the last person to get on the train. And she's, you know.
Yeah, she definitely, and you see her style change. She's very not put together at the beginning, and at the end, she's very, her style is very finished, and she has a sense of self. She still has the fleur-de-lis on her coat, which is important for her character, but it's not worn the same way.
It's a very nice circle, you know, to start with the train, end with the train. And
yes, having those shots near each other. It does, and the thing I think, too, about her character that I really like about her character is, at the beginning, she kind of goes along with everything. And then there's a couple instances where she has the idea and she pushes, let's go off and do this, you know? And I think that's the thing that, and she's not going to go into home ec. You know that because there's a scene where she's trying to make a dress and she's failing miserably. She's not.
And one sleeve's longer than one sleeve shorter.
And I know it's kind of played as a joke in the fact that she can't sew, which in 1966 terms, a lot of people would watch that and go, oh, poor thing, she can't sew. But it's also saying that that's not her path. Her path is not going to be going to be a homemaker and be finished. She's going to go off to college. She's going to go off and find something else. And of course, we know that she's going to be a writer, copywriting, and then do advertising if you follow in the idea that this character is based on Jane Trahey. I think another thing, too, that really is interesting, just popped into my head, is that she, when you read about Jane Trahey, she got bored very quickly, and Rachel gets bored very quickly in this movie. She kind of jumps around. And what happens is one of the reasons why she wrote books and magazine articles and a play, and all while she was doing advertising and stuff, is that she liked to go work on things for 6-8 months, a year, and then move on. So that's why in advertising, she's known for doing the big account, doing the big thing, and then handing it over to her people to run it and keep running it and keep maintaining it. And you kind of see that in this too. Rachel kind of got bored with things. She shifted a lot. And even though she was breaking boundaries, it wasn't until after she pretty much retired in the 70s where she became Jane Trahey to do speaking engagements. She wrote a book about women in power and who has it and how to get it. She's supported various feminist causes. And at that point, she starts to really shift when she's not worried about upsetting clients into the late 70s, early 80s feminist movement. So in the film, one of my favorite parts about this film is the fact that one of the nuns, Mary Wicks, she plays one of the nuns, is a nun in this film. She's the gym teacher and the science teacher. And then she plays a nun in Sister Act and Sister Act 2, which cracks me up because she plays basically the same nun. And I always wondered in my brain, I'm always like, can I connect to these two movies? Because I'm kind of like, it's the same sister. She's just got moved, because nuns move around all the time. She's got moved to a different diocese, and she's working with a different church and a different mother superior, and blah, blah, blah. So in my brain, in my canon, there's the nun here who's the gym teacher and science teacher, and then in Sister Act, isn't she the one that fixes cars?
I think so.
And stuff like that, which she's very proud of the bus. So in this movie, so I thought it was like, oh yeah, it makes sense, because later on she's gonna be fixing cars. So
I thought when you told me that, I thought that was such a funny thing, because there's people get typecast all the time. You know, mm-hmm. Some people get the quirky teacher, side character, and so they're always playing the quirky side character. But
that's kind of what her career was. She did it in movies up through the 60s, and then in the 70s, 80s, did a lot of famous television shows as a guest appearance. And then, of course, some of the last film stuff she did was Sister Act 1 and 2 before she passed. And it's just fascinating to me that it's fascinating to me how your brain kind of connects things. But I was just kind of like, oh, yeah, that's the same sister.
I want to go back to the female point of view, but we know that a male point of view telling the story does not work, since they made a sequel with a male writer and a male director.
Yeah, and I saw it once. I know you haven't seen it. I saw it once because I was excited. I was like, oh, they did a sequel, and I knew that Hilly Mills wasn't back in the sequel. But Rosalind Russell and a lot of the nuns were back.
Yeah, Mary Wicks was. That's why it popped in my head.
And so for me, it was kind of interesting. So I was like, ooh, I'm going to watch this. I remember I had to track it down because it didn't do well. And so it's harder to find. Don't worry. You should leave it in the dustbin of history, because it's really just – it's like really jokey and the respect for the mother superior is not there. The respect for the nuns, it's like
they missed the point of the movie.
Yeah, they kind of missed the point of having these women who all had different lives become, then they became nuns, and they became nuns for different reasons. And some of them were very serious reasons, and some of them found their calling, and that's why they became, like Hayley Mills, and that's why they became nuns. Hayley Mills' character. It just, for me, it's just, it was like, it was just so disappointing. And you could kind of see halfway through the movie that the nuns and Rosalind Russell and everybody was kind of like, we'll do the best we can because they're professional, but they kind of knew it wasn't the same.
Yeah, because this movie, though it has joking parts, it's a serious movie because just because it's about growing up and things like that, but it's also about finding yourself.
Yeah.
And knowing that your situation does not make you who you are.
Yes, I think that's the thing too, and the love and understanding that the Mother Superior has for the women, because she had, as you find out, she had a life before she became a nun, and she understands what's drawing these young women out there, and so she's not. She wants them to go a certain way. It's not. That's not. She wants them to be a certain type of person. But she wants them to be a certain type of person on their and teach and guide them versus force them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing too, is that you do some of the nuns that are there to help guide. They're there to help you have fun and not fun. They're there to have fun and they show the girls as they're growing up that you can have fun doing things that are very serious. The way the Mother Superior treats everybody with respect, and the only people she doesn't treat with respect is basically the men who barge into her office and try to dictate the world to her. Like, this is what we expect you to do.
Yeah, this movie does not look at men fondly.
No. And that's actually a thing from Ida Lupino movies. If you watch her movies, it's kind of funny. If you watch some of her earlier movies that are a little bit more serious, and but especially some of the ones that are the crime or like some of the socially more conscious ones, men often are in the roles that women were given in the 30s and 40s of being the one that is kind of one-dimensional, is there to serve a plot point. In fact, in several of the movies, men are the unreasonably emotional character. Where usually the unreasonably emotional character is played by a woman. You know, the femme fatale who acts, you know, gets mad and freaked out and shoots somebody, and it causes the whole plot to shift. And in her movies, it's usually played by a man.
Her uncle,
Hayley Mills' character's
uncle, is the epitome of
a playboy,
even though he's like wants his daughter and his niece to act a certain way, be a certain way. He wants the world to bow down to him. And so it's really funny when he walks into Mother Superior's office going, "What are you teaching my kids? You guys are being unchristian-like to a nun." And then he has his secretary
waiting for him in the car. Yeah, no, I think that's the thing, that when you have the secretary, and that's the scene where you see Mother Superior turn on him. Like, she was going to support him, and then you just see it in her eyes. It's great acting by Rosalind Russell in that scene. You just see it in the eyes where she just turns on him. It's like, you were going to get my support, now you don't.
And it's very sweet, because in the next scene, speaking to respect for the girls and the love and support of the girls, the next scene she's talking to one of the other nuns about, you know, is it my duty to make sure that, you know, people are taken care of, and it, you know, and is it wrong that I didn't want to send her? I was going to expel her, but I didn't want to send her into that home.
Yeah,
you know, and it's a very sweet movie. Again, if you don't give it the love and respect of the story, then it doesn't work, which is why I don't think the sequel worked.
No, yeah, they were definitely trying to make, because this movie was a surprise hit. Even though it was a studio movie, this was the only movie that Ida Lupino directed that was backed by a studio. Beth's remember the films that she did, six films that she directed under her own studio. They were all, her studio was basically an independent studio that would get distribution through other studios. And so this is the only studio film that she directed. And so there's still, I still think she walked a line on this film. She didn't push a lot of things that were in her earlier films, but you also saw that in her TV shows too. One of the things, I mean, there was a famous quote by Richard Boone talking about her, saying when people asked what it was like to be in a Western, because he was the star of How a Gun Will Travel and being directed by a woman. And so, and Richard Boone basically was quoted as saying, Ida stimulates me as an actor because she knows acting. In a weekly show, you get into acting patterns. Ida gets you out of them. So she had the respect of the other actors because she was an actor. And it didn't matter that they were making a Western. When she showed up on set, she had control of the set. And that was a very common thing. There's another famous quote about her when she's directing a method actor on another show, where he says that he's trying to get into it to do it. And she said, "Darling," I'm probably going to misquote her, but it says something along the lines of, "Darling, who can do nothing but do it, because we only have 3 days to do it." And so the actor, basically, she's saying, you don't have this free, you have to do it now. You have to move forward. And so is, and that's kind of her directing style too. And she has an economy with the camera. And I think one of the reasons she does is because she did a lot of television and she did a lot of low budget features, and she was famous for being prepared. She would have every scene rehearsed. She'd figure out how to shoot it. When she was doing the low budget stuff, she would actually reuse sets. When in Hollywood, in studios, she would use sets that were set up for another movie, and before they took them down, she'd get like 2 or 3 days on those sets, and then they'd take them down so she could shoot stuff. And then she also did things like shoot on location in parks and stuff around LA, so she didn't have to pay money for renting areas. She did a lot of like guerrilla filmmaking that happened in the 80s and 90s with like your people that are more famous, like Robert Rodriguez and Steven Soderbergh. She did that in the 40s and 50s in Hollywood in the middle of all of these big studios. So it's fascinating to me when you start reading about all the stuff that she did. And the way that she worked with young actresses as they were coming up and helped them out.
That's pretty cool. Let me say this so it doesn't sound sarcastic, even though I do think this is pretty cool. I don't know why my voice went up like that.
It's okay. I mean, I think I'm rambling on a little bit here, but I think she's a really cool person that should be given a lot more credit than she's been given. I think it's starting to come around. You're starting to see people writing articles about her and stuff like that. And there's been sprinklings like over the last 20, 30 years here and there, but it's like you see like some of the other famous early women who directed films getting a lot more praise. And it's just kind of like, well, maybe it's because she was a fireball too. I mean, she said, "I'm a bulldozer when it comes to money." She would not let people not give her money to make one of her films. She was very pushy with the money people, but on set she used to say, "I'm very motherly because I don't want them to feel. I want them to feel safe. The actors to feel safe. And the crew to feel safe." So it's another thing that you're starting to see that more and more in Hollywood now, as women are starting to becoming more and more the producers, the writers, the directors. This is the type of set we want to build, and it's like she was just 50 years too soon, man.
Would you recommend this movie?
Yeah, I mean, this is a fun... I think it's a fun movie to see. Hayley Mills doesn't really pull out of her Hayley Mills kind of character. Like, this movie was supposed to be like a bridge. Like, it's a few steps in that direction, which hence why she smokes and she has a couple other scenes where she's not following authority. She's being anti-authoritarian in certain scenes. So she's breaking the mold, but not like running to the other side of the, I'm going to be a gangster's wife now. It's like, no. She understands where what people know her, and she can't freak them out. So she's definitely going that step. And so it's a fun movie in that sense. It's a fun movie in Rosalind Russell. You kind of watch you can kind of watch Rosalind Russell as Aunt Mame, and then you can watch her as Mother Superior. And there's two different women who are very strong, very strong-willed, and leading two different philosophies, but still getting to that point of being their own person. So that's very interesting to me. So yeah, I'd recommend that.
Well, too bad I've already seen Aunt Mame. That would be an amazing episode.
Well, yeah. Aunt Mame is one of those. There's Mame, which is the musical with Lucille Ball, right?
I believe so, yes.
And then there's Aunt Mame, which is with Rosalind Russell.
The movie.
Yeah, the movie.
No singing.
And I think both of them are good films for different reasons, and both of them have flaws for different reasons. So we could maybe do a compare and contrast later if you want to. Did you like this film?
I did enjoy this film. I thought it was cute. It's not my favorite film that you've shown me so far. I'll be honest with that.
No. I didn't expect it to be, honestly.
But I could see myself watching this in the future as just like a fun little popcorn movie. I don't have to...
No, it's a fun movie.
Yeah, it's a fun movie. You don't have to watch it to get all the messages, but you can also get the messages if you want.
Well, I think the thing too that you mentioned to me right after we watched it, you said this is the type of movie that you can come back to later and we'll probably see something that you missed, because there is. And I thought about that. I go, yeah, because I think I noticed some things in this one that I didn't recognize before, or maybe I did and I just forgot.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a good movie. And it's like you mentioned before, it's very serial in the sense of like serial and like,
Episodic.
What did I say? I had something in my head when I was there. I was like, oh, it's like a sketch show with the same characters in my brain. And I was like, sketch show gives it a comedy connotation. Right. But I was meaning in the sense of like... There's different scenes. And they all form together to make a story. And the story is really awesome. But if you're going for a movie that's like... three acts, like usually, like Booksmart was three acts all one night.
Yeah,
into a story. This one's
a little bit, yeah, it's a little bit different structure. This type of structure also was kind of common. It was actually kind of common in the 50s through the 60s. You have Around the World in 80 Days. You have a couple of these other films that are The Young Philadelphians. A couple ones are popping into my head that are over a long period of time. So they basically are telling the story through these like snapshots of the person's life or the people's lives, or they're going around like Around the World in 8 days. They're going around the world, so they're telling you in snapshots as they're going around the world. So it's not a traditional three act structure that you normally get. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
It's kind of like in our other season we did Alfie, which is a similar structure.
Yeah, because he's not he's kind of a blending of the two, because there is definitely
it's a little complicated when you talk about storytelling, because storytelling, even though that they teach us rules and things like that, there's not particularly a set of rules or a set of boxes that every story has to fall into.
I think the thing, too, is there's different structures in the three-act structure. The most famous alternative structure right now is the hero's journey structure. I don't know. It's kind of interesting. It's kind of interesting that the film doesn't follow that traditional structure. All right.
The click clack of Bowie's feet is telling us to wrap this up.
All right. Did you have fun talking about this film?
I did, and I actually liked this setup a lot better.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please leave us a review. You can follow us on Instagram at TML, A Journey Through Cinema, Facebook under The Movie Log One, and on Twitter under TML. We also have a website, which is at TML, A Journey Through Cinema.com. So it should be easy to remember.
Yes, it should be.
So we hope to see you soon.
Have a great day.
Have a great day.